Lost in Transmission, and other adventures in getting water to your tap. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
Everyone prior to that was doing the same thing every day and never stepping back.
What you're looking at on this machine is a robot that's picking up the parts and the scrap plastic at the same time.
By the time that we realized the mutation had crept up, it's at this point.
And
just
I think
too late.
That sort of shaming, blaming approach.
Every time I'm
when the wind types up, it stirs the ocean.
I'm convinced that lives could have been saved by deploying our technology more rapidly.
On today's show, finding humor in kidney transplants, turning cell division into movies, and what if restaurants build like hospitals? By the way, I'm over by the vending machine right now because I want to grab a bottle of water real quick. But before I head back to the studio, I'm going to pour a third of this water out. All right. Sounds crazy and wasteful, right? But that's what happens to Philadelphia tap water. About a third of it is lost on its way to its destination. Just one of the many intriguing facts Carolyn Beeler found when she traced the journey of tap water, starting with her morning routine.
When I wake up, I need water for practically everything I do in my morning routine. From flushing the toilet, to taking a shower, to brushing my teeth. That's not to mention watering the plants and washing my breakfast dishes and making my morning coffee. Like most people in developed countries, especially here on the soggy East Coast, I get clean drinking water piped to my home all day, every day, for a fraction of a cent per gallon, and I never really think about where it comes from or how it gets here. So today, I've decided to trace the journey of Philadelphia's water. So all the water that flows out of Philly's taps starts at one of three water intakes in the city that sucks in water from the Schuylkill or Delaware Rivers. I'm at one of the two intakes on the Schuylkill River, where all of West Philly's drinking water comes from. And I'm here with Drew Brown.
I'm an environmental engineer for the Philadelphia Water Department. We are at the Belmont Raw Water Pumping Station.
The actual intakes here on the west side of the river, just north of Boathouse Row, are covered by a concrete platform, so you can't see them. But you can tell where they are from the telltale floating crud in the water in front of them.
As the water's being sucked in, all of the debris in the river is going to get trapped on the screen.
So that's why this looks so disgusting. It's
yes.
Like a ton of floating mulch and dirt and water bottles.
Driftwood and some lumber as well.
Pumps across the street in a stately old red brick building suck about 45 million gallons a day from the river and send it to a treatment plant a few miles uphill. That's our next stop. We're walking to the Belmont Water Treatment Plant facility, a couple of yellow brick buildings and a bunch of water reservoirs. This is where all of the water pumped from the Schuylkill at the Belmont Pumping Station flows to be treated and cleaned. Here, water sits in giant basins for about a day, so the large solid particles settle out, and then chemicals are added. Bleach disinfects, ammonia improves taste, and lime and iron make smaller sediment clump together and then sink. The water is finally piped to the filter house. It's a retro teal-tiled building reminiscent of a 1970s-era indoor swimming complex.
Both sides of the hallway here are filled with water on top of filters, and the water's working its way down through the filter.
It smells a little bit like a swimming pool in here from the bleach, probably, huh?
That's from the bleach, right.
The water sinks through sand, fine gravel, and coal to be filtered.
When you crush the coal, it activates static electrical charges on the coal particles that attract the pollutants that are traveling through it, through the filter.
In a lab upstairs, there's a technician who frequently tests the water coming out of more than a dozen continuously running taps, one for each stage in the purification process, from the river to the finished product. After all this work, though, only a little more than 60% of the city's treated water ever reaches customers' faucets and gets paid for. For comparison, in Las Vegas, it's about 95% that reaches customers. In Pittsburgh, D.C., and Cincinnati, it's between 65% and 80%.
Philadelphia's lost water costs customers more than $50 million a year and wastes enough energy to power about 4,000 homes. Some of that lost water just doesn't get paid for, but most of it is seeping into the ground from thousands of leaks in underground water pipes. That's the sound of one leak under Snyder Avenue in South Philadelphia, discovered recently by a Philadelphia Gas Works crew digging up the street for maintenance. When I visited, the water department's Jason Smallwood was standing in the middle of the street, listening to the underground water pipe to find where that leak was.
Are you a leak detector?
Yes. Yeah, leak detectors, yeah.
Do you have, like,
a badge and everything? Yeah, got a gun and billy stick and all that old good stuff. Nah, just kidding.
Amid the clatter of water pumps, Smallwood walked along the street with two geophones. Those are long pieces of black tubing, each with an earpiece at one end and a metal disc at the other end.
Just like a giant stethoscope they use in a doctor's office, but bigger.
To listen for a leak, he puts the discs at the end of the geophones on the pavement, listens to the water noises underneath that are conducted through the metal and into his earpieces, and then he takes a step and does it all over again.
It's like a hissing sound. Shh. That's what a leak sounds like.
And you could pick that up even with this water pump going, and we're right on this busy street.
Yeah. That's why you got to have good ears. If you ain't got good ears, these would be no good.
There are higher-tech electronic devices that can do some of what Smallwood does, but he says his ears and the geophones are faster.
Mm-hmm. As we say, I can hear a mouse pissing on cotton.
Several thousand leaks like this go undetected each year. Two big ones under the Vine Street Expressway lasted about a decade, and each gushed 100 gallons of water a minute by the time they were ferreted out in 2007. Leaks that big can flood basements or cause structural damage to streets or buildings. To find leaks, the city launched dedicated leak detection units in 1979, and today they survey about a third of the city's 3,000 miles of water pipes every year. In 2000, Philadelphia became the first U.S. city to adopt a water audit program that's now considered the gold standard.
They have a tremendous track record of innovative efforts to tackle water losses.
That's the Delaware River Basin Commission's David Sayers. He says in spite of those efforts, Philadelphia still has the third highest water leakage rate among the 50 largest cities in the basin.
Given the fundamentals of an old system, they really have some significant challenges.
The oldest pipes still in use in Philadelphia date back to the 1820s, says the city's leak detection guru, George Kunkel.
When you look at the growth of the city, there was a major growth period that occurred after the Civil War from the 1870s through the 1920s. So, of course, most of the piping was installed then.
Overseeing this old system, Kunkel has made a name for himself in the world of water losses. He literally wrote the book on it.
I usually hold this up and say, well, I realize for a book about water, it's a little dry, but...
But I'm...
Under his leadership, the city has reduced water pressure and in the mid to late 2000s reached historic low leak rates.
Since that time, we've plateaued somewhat, so we're challenged now to get to that next level reduction.
That plateau is about 60 million gallons a day of leaks, more than the Belmont pumping station sucks out of the Schuylkill every day. Kunkel says the city isn't likely to reduce that much anytime soon, and here's why. Back outside my apartment, there's a water main that runs down the street, and a smaller pipe that runs from the street under the sidewalk to my apartment building. The city doesn't own this smaller pipe, my landlord does. Most of the leaks currently in the system happen in these smaller lines, but the city doesn't have the authority to fix them. Homeowners are often slow to do it because leaks don't show up on their water bills. Kunkel says unless the city develops a pipe insurance or warranty program or some other policy change, these tiny invisible leaks will keep sending clean drinking water into the ground. I'm Carolyn Beeler for The Pulse.
So the water that does get to your tap really deserves a prize for all it's been through, right? But still, it's not always an appreciated commodity because to some of us, it tastes a bit funky. Sometimes I feel like I can taste the river and the bleach and the pipes and everything else in between. What should water taste like? We tracked down a foremost expert in water flavor. His name is Arthur von Riesenberger. He's authored several books on water's flavor, and we interrupted his ski vacation in the Austrian Alps so that he could talk to us. Arthur, welcome to The Pulse.
Pleasure to be there. Thank you.
Arthur, what do we look for in great tasting water?
Well, in some ways you look for the absence of certain things. For example, you want the absence of chemicals, things like chlorine, which gives a almost like chemistry lab taste and odor to water. We don't want too much of certain minerals, like sodium might make water taste a little bit too salty. But then, you know, it's different between the Americans and the Europeans, because in America, we know what we don't want in our water, like salt and chlorine and things like that, but we're a little hazy on what we do want, whereas the Europeans, it's the opposite. They know what they want in their water. They want certain minerals because of its medicinal value and health benefits. They like magnesium and potassium and calcium. Those are all considered to be good minerals, which also give water a good taste.
Now, when water is marketed in America, a lot of times we are told where the water is coming from. You know, it's from this spring that is deep underneath a mountain and so on and so forth. How much does that matter, where the water has been sitting?
Well, water that comes from higher elevations tends to have less contaminants in it. As water goes lower, it comes in contact with more agricultural activities, more industrial activities, and of course, human population. As water falls, it percolates down into the ground. So rain comes down, percolates into the ground, and it takes a journey under the ground. And in that journey, it comes in contact with different kinds of rock strata, where it picks up minerals and trace elements. And when it eventually daylights as a spring, it's accumulated those minerals, and it's really like a fingerprint. Each one is very unique. So each spring has its own personality, if you will, and therefore its own taste.
Now, I can picture a sommelier tasting wine. What do you do when you taste water professionally?
Well, we look at water from various parameters. First, in its appearance. Again, it should be perfectly clear. I mean, I guess you'd call it 50 shades of clear. But if you have a color in the water, which can come from iron, for example, that would make the water look orange. If you have a little bit of algae in water, it would give it a green tint. Sulfur might give it a yellow tint. Those things you don't want in your water. Then you do an aroma check, as you would with wine. You sniff it and see what aromas you pick up. Generally, it should be odor-free, but things like chlorine will give it an aroma. Then you'd have a taste of the water, where you roll the water over your tongue and all the taste buds in your palate, trying to pick up the different nuances of saltiness, sourness, bitterness, sweetness, so forth. And then you make a note of what kind of effect that water has. Is it refreshing? Is it clean? Is it clear? Or is it salty or heavy or mineralized? And rate it accordingly. Then there's the mouthfeel. Some waters might have silica in them, for example. And silica would give a texture to water that's almost slippery. Then there's the aftertaste. Once you swallow the water, how does it leave your mouth? Does it, has your mouth got a residue in it, or is it refreshed and clean and you drink more of it?
Arthur, when you're back in the U.S., do you drink tap water ever?
Not very often. I mean, I must say, where I live in Santa Barbara, California, the tap water is so mineralized, but with not necessarily the good tasting ones, that you can virtually chew it. So I'm not very fond of it.
Arthur, I'm drinking some Philly tap water, which is fine, but I don't think it's going to win any awards. But I want to thank you so much for being on The Pulse.
It's really been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Arthur von Wiesenberger is a consultant to the water industry and a professional water taster. Coming up on The Pulse, what if the minute and at times bizarre details of medical bills caught on in other industries?
43 cents for greeting the diner, $1.46 for taking the order, $1.64 for serving the food, 62 cents to ask if everything's okay.
And your total? Still to come on The Pulse. You're listening to WHYY. Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence believes in living like nothing can hold you down. But to live worry-free, you need someone to fall back on. That's why they offer doctors and hospitals across the region and a range of health plans designed to help fit your budget. Independence is here to help. This year, you may be eligible for financial support. Independence Blue Cross.
Live fearless. More information at IBX.com or 1-800-ASK-BLUE.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is committed to building healthier, more vibrant communities through disease education and awareness initiatives, access to affordable medicines, and partnerships with nonprofit organizations across the Philadelphia region and beyond. In 2014, AstraZeneca donated $18.5 million to nonprofit organizations for programs and projects aimed at improving health across the U.S. Learn more at AstraZeneca-US.com.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. Four words are fueling a major fight right now. They are at the heart of a Supreme Court case challenging the Affordable Care Act, or more specifically, some of the subsidies people are receiving to pay for their insurance plans. Joining us now to discuss the case and the potential outcomes is Robert Field. He's a professor of law and a professor of health management at Drexel University, and he was in the courtroom for the proceedings. Robert, thank you so much for being here.
Happy to be here.
So what are these four words that are at the heart of this case?
So the magic words are established by the state. And the phrase is talking about who's entitled to subsidies when they go on one of the exchanges to buy insurance. The Obama administration assumed that everyone would get a subsidy in every state. In 16 of those states, the state itself established the exchange and runs it. In 34 states, the states refuse, so the federal government steps in. And that's the case in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. So residents in those two states go to the website healthcare.gov, which is run by the federal government, and that's how they get their coverage.
You were in the courtroom. What was the mood like? It seems like everybody was trying to read the tea leaves and just see what people were thinking.
The mood was quite tense because the stakes are so high. Even though this case would not invalidate the whole law, it would make it unworkable in those 34 states, which means in two-thirds of the United States, we wouldn't have Obamacare. What would happen after that is uncertain. Perhaps you'd have a robust program in the other 16 states, but the law would be a shadow of its present self.
I suppose it's hard to say who is the most important judge in any decision, but a lot of people were talking about Justice Roberts, Justice Kennedy. Could you gauge their reaction?
Roberts was interestingly very quiet. He only made about two or three comments. He's usually not one of the most aggressive questioners, but he's generally more talkative than that. The thinking is that he cast the key vote in 2012 to uphold the act. It was very controversial. He's gotten a lot of criticism for it, particularly from conservatives, and he doesn't want to tip his hand at this point. He may end up being the swing vote again, but I don't think he wants the speculation out there for the next several months. The other question mark is Justice Kennedy, who is the swing vote on many cases that have an ideological bent to them. And he was harder to read. He was tough on both sides. He asked some tough questions of the government involving how the statute is interpreted and whether the administration stretched the bounds too far in the way they interpreted it. On the other hand, he was very concerned that if the challengers prevailed, the statute would then have an unconstitutional aspect to it. But the key person is Kennedy, and supporters of the law took a lot of encouragement from his highlighting that constitutional issue.
The case itself has been criticized and has been called cynical, nitpicky, I guess. What's your take?
Well, it is true that opponents of the law have combed through it word by word to try to find any anomaly, ambiguity, anything they can find that would be grist for a challenge. And they found this within a 2,000-word page law. It's not surprising that they were able to find something. In ordinary times, long, long ago when there was bipartisanship in Congress, when you had a major statute, you'd always find errors in it. It's very hard to pass something this long without a mistake. And what would happen is you'd have what's called a technical corrections bill that would fix them, and both of the parties would just sign on to that without problems. Well, in this highly supercharged partisan environment, there isn't going to be a technical corrections bill. So when a glitch like that is found, there's zero chance that Congress is going to come back and fix the law consistent with what its supporters had envisioned originally.
What will happen next? When can we expect a decision?
So at the end of this week, 2 days after the hearing, the court will take a preliminary vote. And the odds are that that vote will be the final outcome. But, of course, there is strict secrecy. There will be rumors. There will be gossip. But we really won't know until they issue the opinion, which is almost certain to be at the very end of June. Now, for the 2012 case, there's an interesting story because apparently Justice Roberts switched his vote. That preliminary poll right after the hearing had it going 5-4 against the law, with Roberts voting against the law, and he switched sometime in May, and that's what determined the final outcome. So even though there will be this preliminary vote, there could be a major drama going on behind the scenes for the next couple of months, and we'll only know after the fact.
If the court decides against the law, what will happen? Does the administration have a backup plan?
It's likely that they have some kind of sense of what they would do. In the meantime, a few Republicans have said they're going to draft their own backup plan, and that would basically ease the process of ending the subsidies. Justice Alito, who clearly was antagonistic to the law, made an interesting comment at one point. He said, "We don't have to invalidate the law and have that take effect immediately. We could order that it take effect gradually or that the law stay in effect till the end of the year." So it is possible that the court would provide for a transition period. However, at the end of that year or however long it is, there would be chaos in the insurance markets in those 34 states.
Do you care to make a prediction?
I will make a prediction with the caveat that I have no track record for being correct in these things. I would predict that Roberts will probably side with the liberals in upholding the administration. I would say there's about a 50-50 chance that Kennedy will do the same. So we'll probably see either a 5-4 or a 6-3 decision for the administration. On the other hand, I could be surprised, and it could potentially go the other way. It's not a slam dunk for the administration by any means.
Robert Field, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Robert Field is a professor of health management and policy at Drexel University, also a professor of law. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Have you ever tried to find out how much a medical procedure is going to cost before actually having the procedure? We've been exploring this issue here on The Pulse, and turns out it's really difficult.
So I called around to a lot of different hospitals to find out how much amniocentesis costs.
How much was the CT scan going to cost?
No one would tell me.
And the two nurses just looked at each other in shock, like, we don't know.
I ended up getting a bill a month later saying that it was $1,000 more.
It could put me in overdraft or serious financial difficulty.
Last week, we launched a new initiative called WHYY Price Check, together with Clear Health Costs, and we're trying to create some transparency around pricing for medical procedures. Joining us now is reporter Alana Gordon, who is keeping track of this project for us. So, Alana, people can go online and put in information from their medical bills.
Absolutely. So we have a form at whyy.org/pricecheck where we're asking you to enter in some of what you were charged, what you paid for common medical procedures. There's an easy way to do that when you look at an insurance statement or a bill that you receive. And we started this last week, and already we've gotten over 80 responses.
And what are people sharing? What are some of the interesting things you're seeing?
So it's been really interesting. There's a range of medical procedures people are telling us about, whether that's an echocardiogram costing anywhere from $1,000 to $6,000, depending on where you go. Colonoscopies has also been really interesting. To start this off, we're really curious about colonoscopies and mammograms. They're just really common procedures. And for that, we've seen the price range anywhere from under $2,000 to nearly $8,000.
For a colonoscopy?
Yes. And now that's not necessarily what you paid, depending on your insurance and what it's covered. but pretty big difference.
And people can also use this site to kind of get a sense of what these procedures cost in our region.
Yeah, it's a searchable database. So Clear Health Costs has actually even surveyed providers and payers in the region for their pricing information. It can be really hard to get. So that's why it's also interesting to hear from you about your experience, what you were charged, what you paid, so we can all search that.
We're hoping that over 1,000 of you will participate by providing information. Again, you can do that at whyy.org/pricecheck, and it takes under 5 minutes. I've done it myself, so it's really quick. Alana, thank you so much. And we also have been getting some emails from people who are interested and have questions or stories to share. One of them came from Don Greenfield. He had an interesting experience with medical bills and a very good take on it. So we asked him to come to the studio.
Well, about a year or so ago, my wife had got sick and needed to go to the hospital. And it was one of those things we didn't shop around because we had to get in there right away. So when it was all done and she came out fine, the bills started to come in. And from the hospital or the other billing entities, it wasn't completely clear what was going on. So I went to my insurance company's website and looked at the explanation of benefits. And my eyes opened up and my jaw dropped. It was just excruciating level of detail. There was the operating room. There was the recovery room. There was the room and board, the pharmacy, medical supplies, sterile supplies. This is all on the explanation of benefits.
So this got Don Greenfield thinking, what if restaurants built like hospitals?
Get Well Food Services Incorporated would list the cheese quesadilla, 23 cents, French fries, 12 cents. Apple juice, 9 cents. This is just the cost of the item. It's not what you are going to pay for it in the end. And down below, there's an entry for Dining Room Management Incorporated, where there's a dining room occupancy fee, 38 minutes at $3 an hour, total $1.90. A table, class 2, 4-seat capacity. The preparation costs 74 cents. The occupancy is $1.01. A surcharge for the window location is 44 cents. And so forth and so on. There's also a charge for your trip to the restroom, standard stall fee, 74 cents, 29 cents for the flush, 18 cents for the soap, and 32 cents for the towel. Your total bill to Dining Room Management Incorporated is $9.22.
But that's not all. That's not all. You'll also be billed for your use of plates, silverware, condiments, salt, pepper, and...
And the Dining Personnel Managers Incorporated portion of the bill, you have the waiter, whose name is Carrie Dishes, who charges 43 cents for greeting the diner, $1.46 for taking the order, $1.64 for serving the food, 62 cents to ask if everything's okay.
How's the Italian food in this restaurant?
Good.
Three water refills at 27 cents each, and a fee for delivering the bill and taking the payment. The cashier, who rings the order, charging 72 cents for that service and 32 cents for making change. Finally, there's the Culinary Facility Management Incorporated, who runs the facilities. There's a kitchen fee, 8.3 minutes at $5.43 per hour and so forth. A fuel surcharge, a charge for the pans, the frying oil. And at the bottom, it says, please pay $27.74 for this lunch that you've just had.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
That'll be 62 cents. But how about a tip? Tip is not included, says Don. Don Greenfield emailed us after hearing about the WHYY Price Check Initiative, which is aimed at creating transparency around medical bills. You can participate as well at whyy.org/pricecheck. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and enough with stuff about bills. Let's check out some movies in a custom-built 3D movie theater. And the movies, they are about cells. Andrew Cohen is a professor of engineering at Drexel University, and he helps researchers visualize how cells change over time. Cohen recently stopped by for our series, So What Do You Do?, where we pair researchers with lay people for down-to-earth conversations. Philadelphia musician Keith Pierce asked Cohen.
So what do you do?
I'm an engineering professor, which means I teach and I do research.
Let's suppose you found yourself in a conversation, with, say, with a nervous autodidact.
maybe he took a wrong turn and started playing music instead of going to school. How would you describe what you do to that poor person? It's hypothetical, of course.
So I have a group of students that I work with. And the thing that we all like to do, really, is develop new math approaches and to build computer programs that let us better understand the sort of complex biology that cells exhibit during disease or during as humans develop, as we grow and as we age. And we do it by looking at movies. So it's really, really fun because we're able to look at cells that are alive inside a microscope. If you imagine that you're getting pictures even of a person over time, if I followed you around for a week with a camera and took a picture of you every 5 minutes, how would I share that data with the world? How would we explore that data and try to understand who you are, where you've been, and what you're doing in your life? Think of it as a sort of a crazy art exhibit. And so the most cost-effective way and one of the best, funnest ways to look at that kind of data is the same way that people play video games. So it's high-performance graphics so that we can see you maybe in 3D. We can look at how do you relate to the other musicians over time.
Can you describe how you actually capture the images?
I don't. So here's how my side of things work. I partner with biologists who capture this data, who are studying specific problems, but who need the computational help to be able to understand what the data is trying to tell them.
You get the images. What exactly do you do with them?
What do we do? So we process them, right? We build our own computers, and they're awesome machines. The end product shows the image data, and it also shows our analysis of the data. So generally what we're doing is we're drawing on top of the data to show you what we think we're measuring.
Can you
so it's
help me understand that a little more.
It's imagine that you were to get a cartoon, because it's a fun analogy, but to go in and circle the things that you think are interesting in every image frame and play that back in a way so that you could see the original stuff that you were given, but also so that your highlights, your marks of, well, look at this, in my case, it's look at this cell. Here it is at one time. Here it is a few minutes later. Here it is a few minutes after that. In many cases, when you look at cells, they're transparent.
Yeah.
And when you look at tissue, it's packed full of cells and all other structures. And so to be able to visualize things takes first in the imaging sense. So there is some magic that goes into being able to capture live cell movies inside a microscope. And even the data that comes out of there is really hard to see what's going on, particularly if it's a 3D movie. So the microscopes can actually image in 3D. So if you've seen 3D in the cinema, that's done by using two cameras, the same way that our eyes are sort of two vision points that are spread out a little bit. And that's what gives us the impression of stereo. But when the microscope images in 3D, it actually does it by focusing a laser at different depths in the tissue. So it's interrogating the tissue at all the different locations. So it's true 3D data. So when we look at it in 3D, it looks unbelievably amazing because it's not a simulated 3D done by two cameras, but it's the actual 3D information.
Could you give me an example of something you've already learned from this research?
I'm trying to think of what I can share. We have a few things that we're not quite ready to talk about yet. Here's the one of the most compelling ones, and one of the reasons I think I'm still working in this arena, is that in 2010, we discovered that you can very accurately predict what a stem cell is going to do when it divides, and you can do that while the cell is alive inside the microscope. So by watching how it moves and how its shape and appearance is changing over time, we can, almost 100% accurate, tell you what sorts of daughter cells it's going to produce after it divides. And that's a really powerful potential.
Do you put music into your animation?
That's an awesome question. I have tried a bunch of times. Once I used a sound effect. Actually, it was a submarine noise.
Sonar?
No, the diving noise.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I played that once in a video, and it really surprised people. But overall, we have not found the right soundtrack, although recently it occurred to me that Deadmau5 was absolutely perfect for some of our stem cell movies. But if you'd like to compose something, I'd be very keen.
I would be very interested. We will exchange information upon the conclusion of this interview, for sure.
That'd be great.
All right. Well, thank Mr. Cohen for his time.
Thanks, Keith.
All right. Take care.
Andrew Cohen is a professor of engineering at Drexel University. He was interviewed for our series, So What Do You Do? By Philadelphia musician Keith Pierce. Pierce heads the band Northern Arms, and that's them right here. Coming up on The Pulse, a 1950s Philadelphia discovery that impacts cancer treatment to this day.
So you've got a chromosome 22 with a little bit of 9 on the bottom, and you've got a chromosome 9 with a little bit of 22 on the bottom.
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse and believes that everyone should make the most of every moment. That's why they offer doctors and hospitals across the region and a range of health plans designed to help fit your budget. More at IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca US Community Connections.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Later this month, PBS will air a new Ken Burns documentary exploring one of the most complex and deadly diseases of our time, cancer. Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Emperor of All Maladies, the three-part film, which airs on March 30th, 31st, and April 1st, traces the history of the disease from ancient Egypt to recent scientific breakthroughs, told from the perspective of doctors, patients, and their families. In the lead-up to the release, The Pulse is featuring a series of stories on cancer. We'll discuss innovative new approaches to treating the disease, the side effects of trying to get better, and what it means to be a survivor. To get us started, Todd Bookman takes us back to a Philadelphia discovery that fundamentally shifted the way researchers understand what cancer is, and it still shapes much of today's research.
There's a hallway in Fox Chase Cancer Center dedicated to past successes. Display cases filled with awards, posters commemorating two Nobel Prize winners, and up on a pedestal inside a glass box sits a black and gold microscope.
So this is the original Philadelphia chromosome microscope that David Hungerford used.
Joseph Testa runs a lab here at Fox, where Hungerford was a grad student in the 1950s.
I've looked through this microscope, and it's amazing that anyone could ever find anything.
Despite the primitive technology, in 1959, Hungerford peers through his A.O. Spencer microscope and sees something strange. Inside the white blood cells of certain leukemia patients, parts of two chromosomes seem to have switched places.
So you've got a chromosome 22 with a little bit of 9 on the bottom, and you've got a chromosome 9 with a little bit of 22 on the bottom.
This is Jennifer Morissette, who directs Penn Center for Personalized Diagnostics. She trained under Peter Knoll, the guy Hungerford partners up with, to investigate this rearrangement. Eventually, they write up their findings.
And so they published it in 1960, and they said, look, there's this small chromosome that's associated with chronic myelogenous leukemia. And we only see it in patients who have the disease and not in patients who don't.
There was a link, a clear link, between chronic myelogenous leukemia, CML, and this mutated chromosome number 22, which they label the Philadelphia chromosome. It would take another 30 years to flesh all this out, but researchers determine that the chromosome swap is causing two genes to pair up that usually don't. And when these two genes get together, they send a signal to start making an abnormal protein.
So what this produces is a protein that tells the cells to divide. And what they'll do is they'll divide.
This was the first concrete evidence that cancer, this reckless division, was a genetic disease. And for Noel, the breakthrough came with a sobering realization, because it meant there likely wasn't a single cure. The Philadelphia chromosome caused this one form of leukemia. Other mutations were responsible for different variants of the disease. Each cancer could need its own treatment. But on the flip side, if scientists knew which genes were malfunctioning, they could try to develop specialized therapies. And that's what happened in the late 90s with a drug called Gleevec. It works by going after just that one protein in people with CML, effectively shutting it off so cells stop dividing. Jessica Wapner writes about this advancement in her 2013 book called The Philadelphia Chromosome.
And these people who thought they were going to die, who had been told to get their affairs in order because they did not have long to live, were now planning their next Christmas holiday with their family, were seeing grandchildren born.
Before Gleevec, 30% of patients with CML were alive 5 years after diagnosis. With Gleevec, 90% were surviving 5 years, without many of the harsh side effects of other treatments.
A lot of burning here. It's going to burn for about 10 seconds.
Back at Fox Chase, radiologist Rosaline Parsons is numbing a patient with lidocaine. She makes the injection just below the shoulder blade as he lies on his side.
And the patient we're going to do today is a 42-year-old gentleman with an advanced carcinoma of the head and neck, something called adenoid cystic carcinoma. And he is coming in today to get a biopsy of one of these lesions, and you can see there are multiple lesions.
Parsons points to an X-ray showing cancer throughout his lungs. Using a long, hollow needle, she's going to extract a sample from one of those tumors.
Don't move, okay? Try to stay real still for me.
With just a small amount of tissue, pathologists can run gene sequencing tests to identify possible mutations.
We're done. Okay, we're all done. You did great.
Unlike CML and the Philadelphia chromosome, this patient's cancer isn't yet linked to a single specific malfunction. But his oncologist, Ronnie Mara, ordered the screening because if they find any genetic mutations, she can see if there's early-stage drug trials to enroll him in. Mara says cancer docs are still adjusting to this new way of diagnosing and treating patients.
It is overwhelming, and in some sense, our ability to do this is moving faster than our ability to know what to do with the information.
To help make more sense of this genomic data, the federal government is chipping in $215 million toward research. Here's President Obama announcing the program during his State of the Union address earlier this year.
So tonight I'm launching a new precision medicine initiative to bring us closer to curing diseases like cancer and diabetes, and to give all of us access to the personalized information we need to keep ourselves and our families healthier. We can do this.
That phrase, precision medicine, is getting a lot of buzz right now and could lead to more success stories like Gleevec. But the concept of the right treatment at the right time for the right cancer has deep roots. Roots that trace back more than 50 years to a microscope in Northeast Philly. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott. A new play has premiered in Philadelphia about kidney transplants. It deals with the medical problems, thorny ethical issues, and tumultuous relationship breakdowns that can arise when one person is asked to give a piece of their flesh to another person. Naturally, it's a comedy. Peter Crimmins reports on what's so funny about kidneys.
The play is called Under the Skin, and it's now running at the Arden Theater in Philadelphia.
This story is not about kidneys.
Yeah, it is.
No, it isn't.
It kind of is.
Most of the action takes place in a hospital where an older, bedridden man is trying to convince his estranged daughter to donate one of her kidneys to him. She reminds him how lousy a father he's been, and he reminds her that he used to sing her to sleep as a baby.
What song? You said you sang a song to help me sleep.
Oh, Mack the Knife. Oh, the Sharpie has such
teeth. Dear, I know. You sang me a lullaby about a serial killer.
Seemed to work.
One of the things I liked about the notion of this world
is that it magnifies family issues that are already there.
That is the playwright, Michael Hollinger. He says the transaction of a body part from one person to another has all kinds of dramatic potential.
Within most families, people have senses of boundaries, like, I'll send you a birthday card, but I'll be damned if I'm going to send you a present. Or, sure, you can come visit me over the weekend, but I'm not going to take off my job. I'm going to, you know, I mean, so the things that we say, I'll go this far, but I'm not going to go that far.
So the play is really about rocky family relationships. It's about forgiveness and retribution, the limits of flesh and family, and it's very much about kidneys.
Kidney, for starters, is kind of a funny word. You know, we have kidney beans and kidney-shaped swimming pools. I think there's something about a kidney, the fact that you have two of them, that is interesting, that you can actually share, makes it, in my mind, potentially comical.
Medical procedures can provide plenty of absurdity for comedy material. For example, people who are testing to be a kidney donor have to collect their urine for 24 hours. So on stage, the characters carry around a big orange plastic bucket with them at all times to save their pee.
Do you want me to get you one?
Sure.
This is Marie Manley. I met her at Lackinac Hospital in Wynwood, where she coordinates kidney transplant screenings.
For these.
Oh, wow.
They do it for 24 hours. And I think when people are conscious that they're collecting, they tend to drink more. You know, like it's a test for volume.
If you had to carry around a bright orange one-gallon jar all day like a urine beacon, it's no picnic. But for the rest of us, it's pretty funny. The playwright consulted with Manley to get the details right about transplant procedures, and Manley has seen the play twice. And she says the script gets it right, except in one respect. Usually kidney donations do not involve dramatic family breakdowns. Emotionally, they tend to run pretty smoothly. And she should know because Manley herself is a kidney donor. She did it anonymously, giving her kidney to someone she'd never met.
It was just out of the blue. My husband and I were at church, and there was, we get that church bulletin, and in there is this little blurb from this young woman that said she needed a kidney.
I should say Manley and her husband at the time had just moved into the parish and knew nobody in the congregation.
And I turned to him and I said, I can do this.
Now, Manley said she did give her children the right to reject this idea, but she herself didn't give a second thought to donating her kidney to a stranger. Since that donation 7 years ago, Manley has met the recipient of her kidney. Turns out they live about two blocks away from each other, and they've become pretty good friends. They talk on the phone almost every week, and they don't talk about kidneys.
Even when I am with her, I don't think about that. I guess if it was an arm or a leg that you saw, it would be a different story, but, you know, who sees a kidney? I don't see any difference. It's changed me emotionally and spiritually. There's a connection.
That feeling of connection to a larger body of humanity is in the play. Under the Skin suggests that our bodies are not ours alone, but flesh can be shared communally with friends, family, even strangers. It's a poetic leap that the playwright, Michael Hollinger, is not willing to make himself. He once agreed to donate a kidney to his ailing father-in-law, a transaction that doctors ultimately would not allow to happen. So even though he's prepared to give up a kidney, he was not prepared to give it to a stranger.
The notion of me contacting someone at the other side of the country or across the city who I don't know is outside the realm of what I would currently consider. Though I'll tell you that my sense of what is mine and what belongs to others has definitely stretched over the course of writing the play.
Under the Skin runs until March 15th. For The Pulse, I'm Peter Crimmins.
We just launched a newsletter this week for The Pulse, and I hope you'll sign up for it. You can do so at whyy.org/pulse-newsletter. We'll talk about the stories we're reporting on, send you some of our favorites, and tell you about weird things that happened while we're out reporting, like this dog ruining Ilana Gordon's tape. Or about the time I was leaning in, interviewing a woman about her experience with cancer, and I broke the coffee table, which completely changed the mood from somber to ridiculous.
Through the years, I've gone through, you know, the whole gamut of emotions.
Now I broke your
chair. Don't worry about it.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I always need to.
We'll table that question for now.
So, all this great additional info will be included in our weekly newsletter. Make sure you sign up for it at whyy.org/pulse-newsletter. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Avery Brookins is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, our associate producer. Megan Pinto is our executive producer. Chris Satullo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey is our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we always love to hear from you. Email us with your feedback, your questions, your story ideas at thepulse@whyy.org. We're everywhere all the time. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a generous leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands gladly support WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.